zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my film.
Hello and welcome to the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and this is our cursed update.
Cursed or Kursk?
Exactly.
So it's been a minute, and I guess if we wanted to do the blow by blow thing, there would have been more to talk about, maybe. But I also kind of like our pace. Which is not to say, anyway, just to get right into it, there's been some developments, and this Kursk operation, this cursed Kursk operation is, we were arguing amongst ourselves just recently. I think that's one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about just what would the objective here even is. And for our listeners who may be completely tuned out over the past 2 weeks,
welcome
not
to
even
the National,
2 weeks.
Yes, National Institute for Geopolitics Review.
Yeah.
No gaming today.
No gaming today. No, we don't have. So what is it, like 10 days now? Something like, not quite 2 weeks. The Ukrainian armed forces have been operating in Kursk Oblast, which is not to say it's one of them. From what I understand, I'm not like a super expert on this specific side of things. Both the Kursk Oblast in general and this specific area of it are quite rural compared to other areas of Russia, especially, like, for example, Donbass is extremely urbanized. This is much more like the...
It is, but it's also where the current fighting is in Donbass is pretty rural, too.
And that's another thing, because
looking at footage, there's not much you can tell a difference in, like, Ukraine war footage in Donbass versus Ukraine war footage in Kursk.
When we had our last...
I will say the quality of the roads is generally a little better. Like, they're paved and stuff.
Yeah.
It's really... It looks... I mean, it's very...
Granted, not to say that my... I don't get all the clout. But I did say, I don't know, like... whatever it was, maybe April or something, that I expected Russian arrows. Because... For several reasons, not the least of which was that they were coming up on the last... in Donbass, the last major, fortified... urban area line. I mean, they have other... They can always dig trenches, and there are some... there are, like, Shitholensk A and Shitholensk B towns, right? Dotted all over the landscape. But as far as... I mean, the next real big major urban target is Pokrovsk, which we can... Well, I want to talk about the Donbass theater after we talk about Kursk, but my point is... I did call this in terms of, like, the fighting in Donbass has now moved from because obviously the urbanization essentially sprawls out from Donetsk City itself and Lugansk City to a slightly lesser extent. Between Donetsk and Kiev, there just isn't... Like, those are the biggest cities in that, geographically between those locations. As the fighting proceeds west towards the Dnieper River, there's more and more open countryside, with obvious kind of strategic and tactical consequences. But yeah, about Kursk, so yes, so Kursk, but to your point, yes, it doesn't seem operationally... like there's any big adjustments that need to be made in terms of procedures or orders of battle or anything like that. I mean, yes, it's basically just a direct extension of the existing whatever you want to call it, rhythm of the conflict and procedures of the conflict down to, the major presence of drones. Did you see this? This was sort of almost breaking news as of this recording, that we have what looks like our first confirmation of drones being flown by wire.
No, I hadn't seen this. Was it Lancet, like, or one way?
It's
by
not.
Wire,
it's one ways. Yeah, it's one ways by wire. It's indirect evidence. Simplicius, the thinker, who's highly recommend. I haven't read his stuff for a while, but it's very good. He does a very good job of sort of cutting through the bullshit and providing reasonably timely written updates. But anyway, on his Twitter feed, he had video of, it was crystal clear video all the way up to the moment of impact. No graininess, no white, no noise, no nothing that would indicate any kind of EW. Just a crystal clear video feed on a suicide drone hitting a tank. I think it was more than one, actually. And it was, and the report allegedly was from the Ukrainian side, basically complaining, like, the Russians have these new drones that are completely impervious to EW, electronic warfare, and you know, any attempts to jam the signal or whatever, because they're not using that kind of signal, right? They're using a physical signal traveling along a physical wire. So you had predicted that, I think, a while back, and now we're
this is not
you by yourself, of course, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not top secret. We were kicking this game around in Kurdistan years ago, where it's like, okay, we have these security cameras that are effectively, you know, wired in, right? And they're pretty unjammable. They give us good base security. What if our theory was, we were just wargaming this internally, like, you get a DJI Mavic with the hardline power, you know, like a you get whatever the mat, you get a max, maybe a booster in there. You just get like a, say, even 1,000 meters up, right? Or 500 meters up.
The claim was 5 kilometers, which is not unreal. I mean, it's not unrealistic, but yeah.
No, especially not for a fly-by-wire. Yeah. So, you know, we were thinking about in IRL, or me, like, okay, what if we had this, just a constantly powered normal spotter drone that the base defense guys could be looking at, and, like, you know, because,
oh, like an observation balloon, but yes. Not, yeah, that, yes. Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah,
because we were doing things that we were at a relatively isolated area. We could, sure, we, like, if we were a larger base, we would have had an observation balloon. The bigger ones do have balloons and stuff like that. But yeah, people in the drone combat community have been kicking around this for a long time.
The drone combat community.
Yeah, I actually really like that.
Also, shout out to our, speaking of which, shout out to our boy Delta Schmidt, who's like actively developing what I think shaping up to be the best sport ever, or certainly of the 21st century. The game is you get drones, and each one has a football, and the game is to drop, or whatever, some kind of ball, and the game is to drop the football, quote unquote, on the other team, right? Seems highly, highly relevant sportsmanship. Anyway, great idea, and he's also just working generally on the problem. Yeah, but sorry, go on.
So these fly-by-wires are obviously, a TOW missile is probably the most known thing that's fly-by-wire. It's a very insanely tiny wire. It's got 2 kilometers on it. It's better than other systems just because it's not jammable. It's heavier, obviously. Probably because the TOW missile is so large is that. But I also do wonder if these are, because we haven't seen them, and the Russians really aren't secretive about this kind of thing. Are you familiar with the Bullseye tank destroyer at all?
I'm not sure. Maybe not by that name. I don't know.
You were out of incommunicado, I think, during
pocket,
during we had a long discussion about it in our kind of prep chat, and the Bullseye is a North Korean ATGM vehicle, right? That uses fly-by-wire ATGMs for non line of sight capability with a advertised range of 10 kilometers, so 10,000 meters. It could be though, and those were recently spotted, not within the last month or two, in Donbass. So they could be North Korean Bullseye.
It could just be that. Yeah, that's true. Or, I mean, if they have a 10 kilometer range,
or they were, yeah, yeah,
Sorry, go on.
Or they were using those as like a as a test bed.
Or you just slap a GoPro on one. I mean, like, if you just slap a GoPro on a toe, like, how different is that really, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you already have ATGMs have had like live video feed that non-wire, like the Spike, the Jewish Spike, and well now the Hezbollah clone, or Hezbollah Iranian clone of the Spike they give to Hezbollah also has this capability of non-line of sight. And that's not even a wire guy. That's a traditional, or not traditional, a modern style ATGM.
Sure.
So it's possible these are just bullseyes. It's possible that they're some derivation of it, because the bullseye is a tank destroying vehicle that's like kind of a one complex.
Mm-hmm.
This could have, it could be like
that's a good point. Yeah,
like one that it's not mounted on a tank. Like it could be like a individual, you know, like oh they've taken the system from the North Koreans, they've tested it, and now designed a system and it's okay. Well, let's make one that's just an individual guy with a launcher, which is also like you get into so the line between HEGM and one-way
right,
drone is
right, right. That's what I'm saying. Is at a certain point, it's like, is it rocket powered, or does it generate lift, or does it generate lift with a fixed wing, or does it generate lift with a rotor? And that's kind of your difference, right? It's about propulsion technique at a certain level. Once you're talking about like GoPros slapped on things you're shooting by wire at, you know, in a one-way kind of capacity.
Yes. So I do want to kind of go to the beginning of it, and I want to talk about the first one. There have been two of these incidents prior.
So the Belgorod, the two Belgorod instances,
which were much earlier in the war. Obviously, the Russians were very much in a much more defensive posture during these. They were attempts to, I think, you know, draw forces off Donbass so that for the summer offensive that failed last summer, and they were basically battalion strength, maybe a little heavier, very propagandistic. But
it was spearheaded by essentially like Russian, I don't know, what do you want to call them? Whiteoids? Like, I don't even know what.
A guy whose podcast I used to listen to?
Oh, really? Okay, that's funny. Yeah. Well, yeah, but essentially, that doesn't surprise me at all. Like, these were sort of like edgy Russian Nazis, but like totally brain dead, you know, like the Slavic stereotype, like the potatoes and vodka kind of meathead. Yeah. Those guys.
It was all Dennis and those guys who I think are kind of gone fully into whatever it is they're doing over there in the Ukrainian army. But they were also, like, never that large and, you know, it was mostly, you could tell, it was Ukrainian military doing the bulk of whatever, you know, this was.
Well, it was clearly some kind of photo op, I guess is my point. Like, there was never a pretense that it was more than an opportunity to generate articles, headline, you know, Russian dissidents lead strike into Russian territory kind of thing.
Yes. But I want to just the pure military aspects of those raids or assaults, we would call them, is...
Raid is good. You could call that a raid.
Yeah, the... Russian border guards are in the area. All those checkpoints are border points are manned, but I believe they didn't want to. The border guards knew there was pretty heavy forces behind them, and pretty much broke at the sight of, like, you know, a big convoy of BMPs. They, you know, fired you know, once to, you know, because you get your paycheck, and then they just broke. And then within like a day or two, the Russian regulars were there and pushed them back. Or they
the Ukrainian border, I mean, border, I mean, you need, obviously, border units, but they're just not ever going, like, there's a reason why they're border units and not regulars, right? Like, it's just, that's not what
you're generally just, like, the little equipment they get, like, much lighter. And
that's what I'm saying, it's like, you're not going to have, like, tanks in the border guard, like, generally speaking.
But this time was different in that sense where, that, at least initially, was I would assess one brigade, and DPA also assesses one brigade
for the initial, and then it's quickly reinforced by like two or three at least more.
So it was one brigade, and then one more brigade of reserves to exploit, and they cash in and have set even, I think now 3 to 5 is kind of the estimate.
I want to point out that
in Kursk, the border guards did not break.
Mm-hmm.
They maintained a fighting retreat the entire way. Like, the border guards are
one unit reported, I don't know which one, but I heard a report that one unit was encircled but maintained like didn't surrender and was relieved eventually. So yeah, it was quite a pitched fight.
But that actually is kind of a bad sign, because when the border guards were willing to just break and, you know, fall back hard, they knew there were heavier assets behind them to do this fighting. The fact they didn't break means they knew there was no one behind them, right?
Well, right away.
Yeah, and it took 4 days to get anything there. Like, the Russians did run rampant outside of
the Ukrainians,
a couple towns. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, the Ukrainians, outside of a couple towns, the border guards were holding. And there are also reports that I think are just wholly bullshit, because I've seen them contradicted directly by Russian sources, where it's like, oh, well, in Belgrad, only in Belgrad, there was a pilot program to stand up, like, village militias in all these villages.
Nah, that's bullshit.
And people were saying, well, the program didn't get to Kursk. They wouldn't let it happen.
And
they were getting criticized. And I saw people getting criticized for that. And then I saw other Russian propaganda stuff saying, like, well, they were fighting with the border guards. They joined. I've seen absolutely no indication of any kind of militia-type forces on the Russian side.
The civilians, as far as I can tell, are just being evacuated.
I'm seeing a lot of heavy criticism for them not even rolling out. Like, this program should have been rolled out across the whole border. It was the Russian military being conservative and arrogant that they didn't start, you know. Because it is apparently a real program.
I can imagine that there's a real program doing that. I don't know. I also question, frankly, the...
Well, they were also anticipating battalion-sized raids,
exactly. Yeah. Well, okay, and now Armchair Warlord, who is another great follow on Twitter, I'm sure most of people listening to this do. Anyway, he was proposing, I think there's something to it, that although we see essentially 5 brigades worth of unit patches at this time, that there's nowhere near 5 brigades worth of personnel. And I mean, you've commented, you were on this beat a lot, I mean, at least probably about a year ago, about, you know, how under strength they were fighting. You basically knock everything down a tier. Everything is like essentially a third strength. And then I saw just maybe a couple days ago, it was like The Economist or Foreign Policy Magazine, one of these kind of like neoliberal, neoconservative, indistinguishable type outlets, but like, you know, relatively prestige, you know, high status liberal press, admitting in print with an interview that they had with, I think it was like a company commander or something like that, saying that they were fighting at 25%. And that there were units that were at full strength, but based, the number that he gave for like the mode whatever was 25% of its paper strength, at least in Donbass. But you have to imagine that's just this is like the general state of the Ukrainian army. So, like, I don't want to get into necessarily. I mean, who knows how many actual boots Ukraine has on the ground in Kursk? Do you want to guess? Do you want to play that game?
I've seen pretty. Also, it gets into a blur of what's actually across the border and what's like in reserve or support roles still across the Ukrainian border. I would say 10,000.
That sounds about right. But I mean, I think maybe a little high.
The front. "Quote unquote."
No, I would include reserves with. I would include. I don't think they have more than 10.
Well, no, that's the other thing. I'll call it the front, like the axis. I guess you call it.
Okay.
To use the
right, term. Right, yeah.
There are definitely what I would consider 3. So when I say you can always knock down the Ukrainians down like one tier, that's true. There's a bit of nuance there. I think that's for like fast analysis. There are like fully equipped brigades in the reserves.
Yes, and what set this attack apart is that it seems to have been conducted with fully staffed and fully equipped units.
I would say at least the first. The three that I would point out as probably fully equipped, they are also traditionally like especially the 80th Air Assault Brigade, which is actually like mechanized a mechanized armored brigade actually.
Right.
It is probably the premier. One of the few like firefight with the Wehrmacht called firefighting brigades.
Yeah, they just right. They get pulled off the line to go wherever.
Yeah, like basically they're mobile reserves, but like elite armored mobile reserves that can fill gaps. The 88th, 22nd, and 80th are
all committed
there,
yeah.
And that's three at full strength. Ukrainian full strength is also low. It's 2,000 men in a brigade at full strength. So that's at, and those guys are definitely in across the board. At this point, all three of those are across the border. That's at least 6,000 across the border directly.
Yeah, that sounds about probably let's say five-ish with losses at but yeah.
Yeah, and then there's all kind of people standing like in the reinforcement because the positions they left in
In Donbass, which is like the other side of this, but we'll get there.
Yeah. So that's a lot of soldiers, actually. Like, that's 6,000. Like, that's a effective. You could call that a light division, you know. So that's a surprise assault. The thing is, like, until very recently, no one's been home, right? Like, the objective of this, I think, is the weird part because, like, they used a heavier force, I think, because they realized that the Russians were ready for a battalion, so they needed at least a brigade. And then the Russians were ready for maybe a battalion, but they didn't have anything there, and they got pushed back really far, so they sent in the exploitation reserve, which you just have as a matter of course. You can do one of these raids, right? And I think the analogy
The
analogy I used was that they were trying to steal copper out of the house, and the door was unlocked. You know, they were going to go like bash up the AC unit and take the copper, but.
But what's the copper in this analogy? What's the copper in this analogy?
The same thing they've been doing in Belgrade. Like the propaganda, like we took this village, there's a revolution coming out now to defeat Putin.
That explains sending a brigade, especially if you sort of by experience you understand that an isolated battalion sized unit is just gonna get wrecked. Okay, but what if we send a brigade though? And you get some results. I can see that. What I don't see is like pouring men and equipment. To what end?
Okay. So let's say you have one brigade. You usually have two, obviously. You have one brigade to go in, and one brigade if it's a disaster to either cover their retreat or whatever. Like a rescue brigade, effectively. Which is, I believe. So you have two brigades there already, and. I believe that was 22nd and 88th. 80th was sent later. But so you go in, there's like no resistance, but if you keep going further, you'll be too thin, obviously, on the ground. So you send in the exploitation brigade or reserve brigade to reinforce them. And then they go in, and it's day three, and they're still not seeing any like Russian regulars. Why not? Like, why not make this as effective as it can be, right? Like,
but effective in what sense? That's what I'm saying. I still don't hear a goal.
Like all of the propaganda damage that you inflict by like taking one village and flexing is like magnified immensely. Like they've taken now like 14 villages and they're flexing, like.
Yeah, but then you have to hold them. Like or else it just does. I mean, there's
to what degree you have to hold them is the question. Like,
well, and this gets into maybe like how you think this is going to shake out, which I think we're in broad agreement, maybe for different reasons, that they're probably going to be able to withdraw more or less intact. In other words, I don't know if intact is the right word. Without getting cut off, surrounded.
Losing coherency. And,
yeah.
They'll retreat in good order.
Right. Yeah, that's, I think, the most likely outcome. But I don't know. I mean, I get what you're saying. It's not implausible. I think they're going for the nuclear reactor. I don't, especially after,
the thing is you actually get nothing from that.
True. What do you mean?
No, like they're like you would have to actually hold that. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's say
hold it hostage. You just like, yeah,
they say we're going to like, melt this
no,
thing
they don't
down.
Say they don't say that. I mean, they don't say that. They claim no. They either do a nuclear provocation or they sort of let it be known. You know, they basically call it a false flag or prepare the world. You know, for a they get something ready that's going to be called a Russian nuclear thing in the global Jewish press, and use that as political leverage. Really, use that threat.
Not even really attacking in that direction so much. They're kind of going where the
right Russians because aren't. It's a militarily retarded thing. Like the whole thing is just militarily retarded. So like I get what you're saying that they're not really heading in any direction. That's the thing.
Yeah. Well, they're just still doing a raid. It's just bigger.
I guess. I mean, yeah, but then these are their last. I feel quite comfortable saying, you know, whatever. There is a question about replacement, and it's true that because the United States, you know, people don't realize. As you were, you know, full credit to you. You were, I mean, of course, this has been known for a while, but you were reiterating, and it's an important point in MapChat that the American agreement with the Army of Ukraine is not we're just going to give you these many Strikers and, you know, good luck. It's you are authorized to keep in your inventory however many Strikers, and when you lose one, we'll replace it, and that's the number of Strikers that we're going to like keep you up. On or not? I mean, strikers. Insert whatever.
Yeah. We call this authorized strength in the military.
Yeah,
you have an authorized strength of
however many. Strikers. Yeah, whatever it is. So okay. So just you know, one striker down doesn't necessarily mean that there's. I mean, it's not quite as simple as that means that their capability is diminished permanently by that capacity or whatever. Nonetheless. They don't have. It's very clear. It's very, very clear. They do not have much in the way of vehicle reserves, especially. Like I mean, or to the extent that they do, they're in the deep rear, probably centered around Kiev, not available for use in the Donbass. I mean, where they're needed, where they're being asked for, and including. I mean, they don't even have artillery shells at the rate. They don't. It's what was it? In the same interview where they said, I mean, a couple days ago, this is very recent, where he said it was units were about 25% strength, that they get like two artillery fire missions a day or one every other day. Or I mean, it's down to like you get to send a shell every 24 hours at a target of your choosing if you're on the Ukrainian side. It's versus, you know, hundreds per day just of artillery, not mentioning the glide bombs, etc., on the Russian side. So they are...
Got it. Which brings me up to one more point.
Yeah.
Were I the Russians, I would be giving the Iranians whatever they wanted. Intel, equipment.
Yeah.
In order to strike Jewish artillery shells, hey, like, I don't care. Like, we have opportunity. If there's any known... If there's a building in Israel with more than 100 artillery shells...
Blow it the fuck up. Yeah, absolutely.
Because the... Like, that will... So, artillery shells have been my particular autism for this war. Because I have, like, marginally more confidence in the Western industrial military complex than you guys do. you know... They have achieved not their goals, but the U.S. is producing about, a little under this maybe, 2,000 shells a day, which is a ton more than the beginning of the war. A lot, like factor of, I think, four.
They're, what more. Is it, like half behind?
And
go on.
And the European, like, we call this the German, but I'm saying it means the entire, like, European... complex, but we'll call it just the EU or the Germans for brevity. They're producing maybe 800 a day, maybe. If all that goes to Ukraine every day, that is enough to maintain their what do we call that? Like pre, I guess what you call that, like the first summer of the conflict level,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, where they were, yeah,
doing things like their own offensives, and like that's enough to cover their ass. It's not ideal, but their own needs, any Jewish needs, those will tap into that very, very hard, very hard. And I think that also The American number gets weird because we've been doing something with the South Koreans. So the South Koreans have their own like autistic fuses, but they have the same shells. So there have we have been of importing course. South Korean shells
and then replacing them the fuses. With American fuses. Yeah, I heard about this. Yeah,
because fuses actually somehow are like one of the few points in production where there's just a ton of them. Like American fuse production is way higher than shell production, so this actually works out well for us. I don't know how they're counting in the Korean reshells in that number of 2,000, or if they are at all. So who knows? I have also seen evidence by well, sloppy OPSEC, but I think who cares, of the American Artillery AIT, which is like the school for young artillerymen, the where you get the MOS as an artillery person, artillery trainees, if you will. They were firing South Korean shells in their training, which is implies that all production is going to Ukraine, and they're doing these like all these like weird side deals are actually just being used by the to fulfill the American Army's immediate needs because like it's not a war zone, so you can use like a shittier, weirder kind of shell.
Yeah,
you don't really like okay the kids weren't as good this year because the shells were worse. We're still gonna pass them on the fucking artillery exam versus like a fire mission, right? So. Yeah, if the Iranians can tie up any level of Jewish shell production or Jewish shell depots, it'd be very interesting. The Jews, of course, are incapable of producing military equipment. Pretty much, they're retarded. They have no military industrial base. In actuality, it's basically a series of houses of cards that like are hiding American production. Like the Jews. The way you see their military industrial complex is they will make a prototype or a new product, right? And then say they're going to adopt it for years and then go back to the American equivalent, you know? Their artillery systems are almost all American. They say they can make artillery shells in-house, but they never actually, like, seem to really, like, do it. They cannot make JDAMs. They're incapable of making JDAMs. They've tried and tried. Theoretically, they have some, like, long-distance standoff munitions that, like, they actually never used in combat. They probably have them at, like, bespoke levels, you know. So any pressure that the Jews are under, the Ukrainians will suffer. Because they get last pick, right? Yeah.
Yeah, no, that, that makes perfect sense. I'm just thinking about... I don't know. It's an interesting question. How shell hunger is going to fit in with the course of developments? They're certainly starving now, at least in Donbass. The Kursk thing, though, yeah. I just maybe to wrap that up. I don't see any logic, I guess, in taking villages for the sake of taking villages. And while there is, yes, there's a certain propaganda value, and in a certain sense, that's primary. I was listening to NPR, and they had on, Volker, the previous George W. Bush's U.S. ambassador to NATO. So already it's sort of like, okay, NPR, you know, I guess, you know, George W. Bush is my new best friend or something. It's funny how libtards have really come around on W. But he was basically saying, it was really eye-opening to me because it was, I heard basically the same thing on, it's like across the conservatard libtard spectrum, the unified message from Jewish regime media is this Kursk attack, you know, really shows that the Ukrainians have the will and the strength to win, and we just need to, you know, support them but it also shows, you know, that they're making a big deal actually about like how this is going to cause essentially, their theory of the war was that this was somehow this was going to cause the Russian people to rise up and revolt against Putler. Surprisingly, I was listening also to who was somebody at the Cato Institute. It was really funny actually because he the interviewer began by saying with the Cato guy, like, so, you know, what's the deal, kind of generally? And he said, well,
wait, I should ask, was this on NPR?
No, that was on a CBS affiliate.
You think I'm surprised they had a Cato guy and didn't just grill him on the Project 2025 stuff, because that's all they give a shit about, it seems.
That's
like
what I'm saying, is it's like, this is, it's across the regime media approved ideological spectrum. It's not a libtard thing or a conservatard thing or even a big brain centrist thing. It's like, this is the message that the normies are getting. It was basically like, but it was really funny. It was Cato guy started by saying that, well, you know, Putin has this theory of the war that Ukraine is Russia's back door, or, you know, or whatever, backyard, and he's not actually fighting Ukraine, he's fighting NATO. They're just using Ukraine, or, you know, but essentially he's in a war with NATO, who wants to, like, set up shop in Ukraine and threaten him, and this, and sort of like glossing over like any kind of, I mean, with at some point later on in the conversation, he called, or I forget it was him or the interviewer, but he was calling him maniacal to use the word for, like, in other words, we can't actually deal rationally with Putin, because, like, he's insane and just...
This is the when you know the U.S., you know, think tankery people are cooked, it's or when you know they're just, like, being lazy, you see this stuff, because that's actually, like, in serious, like, I don't want to wave around my degree, I don't talk about, like, yeah, you know, right. Reason, but, like,
obviously, no. That's not
the
how
idea
these
of
yeah,
a
yeah.
school of thought of which you just take the other leader as irrational... is retarded, and no one actually believes this, who does this stuff seriously or even academically. Like, the theory of the mind of this is just a madman, blah blah blah, right. Blah, is like one of my not red pills, I don't call that, very early on there was a, I forget what the class was, it wasn't political economy, it was something like that though. Anyway, we were doing this bit on it was some kind of politics class, this is very early in my undergrad. And the teacher, I think he usually does this every year, was doing a bit of trolling, and he was like, he was interested in the school of the pro nuclear proliferation school, which is that you should give every single country nuclear weapons. Based into
now, yeah, that's so pretty based. I mean, that's,
I've come around to it in a serious way now, but it's clearly a kind of a joke or a theory to demonstrate a greater point. Right. Which was, people were saying, well, the first objection was, well, this is actually right. This was right, not right after. This was. People were realizing the North Koreans had nukes. Everyone knew they had them, but, like, it was becoming public knowledge, you know, more commonplace in public to acknowledge the Koreans had nukes. So this theory was actually getting quite a bit of a shot in the arm. And people were saying, well, what if the Iranians got nuclear weapons in the class? Wouldn't they just, like, nuke everybody? And he just did the thing, like, what is the point of the Iranian nuclear program, right? Like, why does a country get a nuclear program at all? And... the answer is to, like, ensure the existence of the regime,
right,
or the government, right? It's not actually to, like...
to just nuke people.
Them to shoot them, right? You build them to ensure your state survives. So the Iranians have built nukes to make sure their state survives. Clearly they have an interest in their state surviving, right? Nothing would effectively change in this calculus, because look at North Korea. North Korea is led by... he did the bit like, oh, it's a bad man, crazy, you know, communist Juche state. They haven't fired them at the South out of a fit of, you know, rage or whatever. People don't use nuclear weapons in, like, a wrathful way. You use them in a very cold, like, you run the numbers and, like, oh, fuck, we got to use them, you know, way. And, you know, the class really couldn't break his shield on that. Like, you know, it was very funny to watch. And I was like, I was also like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, yeah, you could just... give everybody nukes, you know, as an exercise, right? You know, and there's some degree of, like, oh, because like we were all doing serious business, we weren't doing like the mad mullahs. We were doing like the mullahs right. Are our country. They are a government. They are a state. They're not going to do this. The mullahs like being the mullahs, right? They, you know. So yeah, I think there's an aspect to that which is like, as soon as you hear somebody in the think tank space calling anybody crazy or insane, or
well, as I recall, it was the interview. He, as I recall, it was the interviewer saying that, not Cato guy, but he was sort of nodding along, right, and didn't do anything to contradict. He, what was funny was he basically like conceded all of the actual substantive element. Like as they were talking, he essentially said, you know, he sort of let it. Just acknowledged at various points, like, oh yes, well, you know, it's actually all American and to a somewhat lesser extent European equipment that the Ukrainians are using, and oh yes, you know, we would like this to end with Ukraine acceding to NATO, and oh yes, well, you know, it was just like everything he said over the course of it contradicted his upfront statement of the case, which was, you know, Putin essentially, like, even if he wasn't using exactly that language, it was very much, he wasn't not using it either, right? And it was the...
Yeah,
the,
I want to point out, like, when I say people being smart, I mean, like, Peter Zeihan won't say that shit.
Yeah, right.
Like, that's, like, to his credit. He won't say Putler is crazy. He will say Putin is bad, needs to be opposed, but, like...
Well yeah, but he would also... But that's the thing, I guess, maybe this is, like, a Peter Zeihan tier thing of, like, I guess I don't know what Peter Zeihan... Does Peter Zeihan say that Putin is factually wrong about Russia de facto, like, actually being in war? Like, the actual enemy here is NATO?
Like, yeah, I mean, I don't think he does that. Like, right. I don't think he's... Yeah.
He's not even that dumb, and that's the case. That's what I'm saying. And Peter Zeihan... Well, that's the sort of bigger picture. As I'm listening to this, and I'm listening to Volcker say exactly the same thing on NPR, it's occurring to me, I'm like, holy shit. The mode nigga zoomer on YouTube, just watching random, not even necessarily like the good, like, you know, Willie OAM or DPA, like just the mode zoomer watching YouTube videos on, like, has a better understanding than the people writing the white papers and, you know, getting on the telephone with people in the State Department. Because Volcker, okay, he's like a former ambassador or whatever, but obviously NPR has him on. In part for the propaganda, you know, to, like, because they want their audience to hear certain things, but also because Volcker is, like, he's going to be, I mean, as the former U.S. ambassador to NATO, he's going to know all these people, he's going to, like, have, you know, even if he's not currently making policy, he will be, he will have all these people's numbers in his contacts on his phone, right? And, you know, same with the Cato, like, okay, you know, Trump isn't in power, but that doesn't... Like, does ISW is more insane than Cato, right? Like, they're more disconnected, they're more retarded, they're more just, like, Jewy, and, I mean, they're literally just, like, fucking 100% kiked. I think Cato probably has some Gentile, like, nigger faggots stashed somewhere, right?
Have we covered the ISW cope at all?
No, we haven't. Not, yeah.
No, it's not on Curse, it's a month
just generally, ago,
it was during our break, and there was, like, this scandal, or... Basically, some mainstream U.S. outlet reported in a way that couldn't really be refuted. I forget which one it was. Might have been the New York Times, or it might have been, like, CP. Anyway, so they had some on-the-ground reporters, and of course, actually on-the-ground war reporters will find some stuff out, and maybe you don't want to find out. Tales all the time, right? That there were, in fact, Ukrainians being sent to the front with less than 2 weeks, sometimes 3 days of training. And this Ukrainian person, like, just confirmed that he had complaints from, like, their commanders, he had the soldiers themselves. Like, it was pretty pretty evident that, okay, these guys are being sent directly to the front. Which is how you maybe, like, I mean, we mentioned that desertion problem earlier.
Oh, that also came up. There was a big New York Times article saying exactly what you said about, like, essentially they obviously tried to spin it differently. But, yeah, they have a big desertion problem and a big tied to the big mobilization problem.
Yeah. So but this ISW cope was, after this came out, it was like so, it was such immaculate cope. I actually like, it's chutzpah, right? Like when you see it, realize, oh, it's chutzpah.
Yeah.
Where it was, the Ukrainians are going to, by putting them directly into combat, they will gain like combat experience and on the job training faster than their Russian counterparts.
Oh my god.
So actually, 3 days of training is better. than you know the full 8 week course. Man.
Yeah, right. So because, that's the guy, yeah, that's chutzpah. That is yes. Yep. That's chutzpah.
I saw that and I was like, I was just like, wow, you're all Jews. Like that's yeah. a very like.
Yeah, I don't know really. Yeah, so okay, so clearly they're having equipment problems and personnel problems, and the copes are increasingly brutal.
Okay, I do want to bring up a bigger narrative around the cursed thing that, and I want to present something bigger where I think that Sirski is a better general than Jeluzny.
Oh yes, this was the.
A very contrarian take among like the,
yeah, that's to put it mildly.
The what do you call it? The Russia Shield sphere. So Sirski catches a lot of shit because like as soon as he was appointed to like save Avdiivka, he didn't save Avdiivka. And he responded to Avdiivka in the same way that Zeluzhny would have, which is like Zeluzhny is kind of a very Slavic figure in that he is Marshal Zhukov with a kind of a smile and a friendly thumbs up. You know, like tactically, he was doing like not one step backward shit. That was Zeluzhny, the popular, the people's, the soldiers, general, all the stuff. Like he was popular, but he was doing like not one step backward. We're gonna defend every inch of ground, all this stuff. Sirski is criticized because like Zeluzhny said, I need more soldiers or we're gonna lose, and Zeluzhny said I can do it with what we have, or made like a lower requirement.
No, you mean Sirski said we could? Zeluzhny, yeah. Zeluzhny was asking for 500,000 more men.
Zeluzhny said we need a million men.
Yeah, or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. And his initial ask was a million. His initial ask was a million.
Right.
And like he argued down to half a million, and then Sirski said, "I can deal with a quarter million, maybe." You know, and that was kind of the end. Other political issues aside, we don't reanalyze that the shake up there. But
well, just maybe as a refresher for our real quick, because I do think it's relevant. The political angles there were essentially like the legal status of the Ukrainian government, which is, I mean, there are wartime conditions and you know it's kind of whatever, but Russia has like I mean the way that Russia proceeds is very much by the book. You know, when there's black letter UN treaty type stuff, they do everything in their power to rules lawyer in that particular kind of way. And that it like so when Zeluzhny, part of the reason he was removed was yes precisely because he was seen as a political rival internally within Ukraine to Zelensky, probably rightfully so. I mean, it's an interesting like you know they're not going to have elections. I don't know how meaningful that is really, but it's fuel to the fire of Russian rules lawyer. Sorry, now go on.
But anyway, Sirski had this perception of being like a bit of a butcher, which Zeluzhny dodged somehow, despite like doing things like Bakhmut, you know.
Well, Sirski took the blame for Bakhmut. I mean, at least in the Russian press.
Yeah, but anyway, so Sirski has this reputation as like kind of a butcher or whatever. But and his early work, we'll call it, was clearly like in the mode of Zeluzhny, not one step backward. Avdiivka got pushed back. It was a tried to make it a grind, didn't really even work. Has set up, a couple more grinds. Now, I think this is an example of Zeluzhny being a little more of a creative guy because in New York, the current Donbass hotspot, or New York and Chasiv Yar, you know, in terms of where the fighting actually is, New York had a significant salient that was going to be encircled. Under Zeluzhny, they would have maintained... It was a very defensible salient, as it was, because the threat wasn't, you know, taken yet. Well fortified. Zeluzhny, the previous general, would have just maintained this... reinforced this salient
didn't
until
he do
the
that
very
in,
last second.
But didn't he do that in Severodonetsk? I mean, that was, you know, real OG hours, but they that was a fair... I mean, that was kind of in a similar situation, no?
Yes, I'm saying that's what Zeluzhny would have done. Zeluzhny did do this. This is what he did. This is what he does. He reinforced these salients, and then at the very, very, very last second, when there's like one single road of dirt through a wheat field under ATGM fire, you pull the guys out, right? That's what Zeluzhny's like mode is. Sirski just pulled back and just like let them have like just he pulled out of the salient mostly. It's like a third of it to a half of it has now just been given to the Russians. They didn't fight for it, they just fell back. While they still had, like, many roads to leave that weren't under fire. So, well, how would Zaluzhny have done that? He would have sent these three firefighter brigades there to, like, fight and grind in New York. Instead...
Oh, this is super contrarian. This is so contrarian, I love it.
I have freed up... I have these reserves. I'm not going to burn in a retard grind, because I'm not Zaluzhny, who's like Zhukov with a fucking smile, who not one step backward, blah, blah, blah. No. I'm going to take the loss there, lose some ground, whatever. It's about to be encircled anyway. And I'm going to achieve the same amount of, like, pulling pressure off this front by doing it somewhere else. Like, we're going to go with the strike where they're weak with our firefighters instead of, like, trying to put up the fire where it's raging, you know? And this worked, and the guys responding to this are not mobile reserves. They are, the Russians responding in Kursk are the Marines and Akhmacht, the Chechens, and Wagner. They're calling them Special Forces now. That's the Russian code for Wagner is now, like, Russian Special Forces have entered, but it's all Wagner guys. Those are deeper reserves than the regular mobile reserve.
Shock troops.
This is not a shock troop battle. Actually, you want
this is but it is though. No, it is. That's what I'm saying. Like when
you
throw
want regulars, you want BMPs and regulars. You don't want Akhmat in their fucking Humvees and Jeeps. You know, if you had the first guards armored, you want the first guards armored. Like you don't want your weirdo light, like manpower heavy urban fighters. Like it's clearly if there was a motor stroke unit there instead of these guys, they would be infinitely preferred. And I'm not gonna budge on that. Like you don't send like elite quote unquote like how they use them as urban fighters into the kind of fighting in Kursk. If you send whoever you have, and it's closest, obviously, right? But the mobile reserves are way out of position. They were probably in Donbass. They weren't behind the line, and
they're still in Donbass. They're like they're chewing Donbass up. Like the base of operation, like Russian operational tempo has increased by in Donbass has increased by 50% since the Kursk invasion began. They are moving faster than they were. Precisely, I mean, like okay. Like yes, I get
because Sierski made a call, which was like, "Hey,
I don't exactly disagree. I mean, here's the thing: Ukraine is incapable of winning this war; just always has been. So, it's a question of do you want to lose slowly, or do you want to pursue a high variance strategy that, you know, it's like the worst team, the worst football team, can sometimes win a game. If they can get into the fourth quarter and get in position to score, any given Sunday, right? Exactly. Like if you're one score down with 2 minutes to go, you can win the game even if you're the worst team, and that's the strategy that Sierski is pursuing. And I think you're right in that Zaluzhny. Now, whether Zaluzhny, how much of that is Zaluzhny's fault, and how much of the butcher reputation is, you know, gets a portion to one or the other. Sure. I mean, I guess that's...
I think Zaluzhny didn't want it. Zaluzhny was very conscious of his reputation.
Yes. Well, that's certainly true. He was playing the political game. That's part of why he got removed.
And Searcy was playing a different game, which was, I'm just going to be a loyal guy and do what they asked me to do. It's like, hey, you got to take credit for Bakhmut. Okay. You know, I'll, like, he's a true pro, you know, in that respect. And that.
Well, and it's definitely... It is... As much as I, well, that's, this is so also, why, this is why I'm so convinced, this is why I think that they're after the nuclear plant, is because, like, the operation doesn't make sense, like, you don't toss your best mobile reserves as a flex to capture shithole Lensk A and shithole Lensk B, like, you just don't, it's not, there has to, like, for a photo op, like, I don't buy it, there's gotta be some kind of the goal.
So do you think in a month when they've fallen back from Kursk Oblast, do you think that the manpower committed to quiet parts of the Russian border with Ukraine will be higher or lower?
I don't understand the question.
Will there be more Russian armed forces on the border and on quiet sections of the border than there was prior to this?
Yeah, probably
by a factor of like five.
I don't know about... Maybe. I mean, that's entirely... Yeah, I guess it depends on which... It probably depends on which sector of the border. The real... One of the big picture lessons here, which is maybe part of what we're getting at, is NATO ISR. Like, I think this was 100... This was very similar to the... Pretty much identical, actually. This is really a replay of... Kupiansk. Kharkov Oblast in the fall and winter of 22, where... NATO ISR identified, surveillance.
Yeah, they were lightly equipped Russian troops.
Yeah, they just saw there wasn't enough equipment and there weren't enough men along this stretch, and you could say the Russians got caught with their pants down. I guess I don't. I'll actually like the thing is, there's no like the actual like what is there of actual strategic value? Like nothing until really. Kursk or the nuclear plant, it's just forests and like forest roads. There's not anything there. So like it looks pretty on a map for a time, and okay, you get some headlines, and if that's all you really want, if Sirski's that good a general, he doesn't throw all this equipment for a photo.
After this, they're going to have to commit more men. More Russians will have to commit more men and equipment to the rest of the border.
I just don't think that's going to matter. I don't think that's like the message the Russians are sending, and I think it's. I don't think they're bluffing.
More serious?
No. It doesn't matter. It's that you can do this, and it's fine. Okay, you're causing problems elsewhere, and we'll find a way to deal with it. And it's going to be, from what I understand. The battles in Kursk have been the most fierce. Like, the fiercest fighting was for a while in the north in Kupiansk. It has now shifted to Kursk is the most active region, which is part of why you want Akhmat and Wagner there. But,
Well, this is also a phenomenon where, like, at the end of World War I...
No. What were you going to say?
I mean, this is a phenomenon, actually, when warfare breaks out of a trench or, you know, entrenched mode that... the tempo, like, so end of World War One and beginning of World War One are famously, like, extremely high tempo, right? Moving a lot of ground, falling, and casualties just, like, spike immensely. When you're actually taking and defending ground against, like, maneuver forces, until, like, the losses are going to be really high in Kursk until both sides hunker down in some manner.
Yeah.
So that's a known. Yeah. Maneuver warfare creates so many more losses on both sides that it's...
Right, and
it, why you would want to send you wouldn't want to send your elite. You'd want to send the first guards, Motostrelki, you know, or whatever,
to take the casualties. Yeah, I mean,
whatever, you know.
I think
you want line units here.
I could be a big brain centrist on this. I certainly agree that the Russian mobile reserves are concentrated in Donbass, and there's probably some administrative inefficiencies related to why their special forces have to be sent in as a fire brigade. On the other hand, I think they're putting their best unit. Like, this is clearly Ukraine. Like, this is the best assemblage of combat power that Ukraine is able to put together at the present moment. It represents a significant draw up, not just of like currently available power, but you could say future available power in the form of like the expenditure of reserves. Again, feeds my thesis of it's hard to understand the logic, either military, strategic, or political, of this Kursk offensive, if not as some kind of like the Hail Mary in the football analogy. Like, they don't, maybe it's a third down Hail Mary instead of a fourth down Hail Mary, but. What were you going to say?
My big criticism of this one is not that it's actually a unsound in like, strategic ways. It's that it's too early. I was actually anticipating something a lot like this, but in the event of a Trump election, where Trump has like promised to make peace break out no matter what, the Ukrainians were saying, "Oh fuck, we're going to be sent to the ocean table no matter
Trump,
what."
They know, but that's not. I don't. I mean,
but they want to improve their position at Trump's. So no. I don't think Trump's gonna like achieve peace in like the Q1
if he gets elected.
2025.
Yeah,
if he gets elected, assuming. I don't think we get Trump peace in Q1 or whatever. But I do think Trump will get a Ukrainian and a Russian in a room somewhere in like Geneva.
Yeah, but they're going to present like the Ukrainians are going to demand Crimea back, and like, you know, Putin be prosecuted for war crimes. Like that's what I'm saying. It's like the American regime is delusional and retarded and insane. Like
they're gonna want the Ukrainians to go to the negotiation table with. In theory, I've seen this in the same space as you've looked at the think tank. It's like, well, they will trade back Kursk Oblast land they've taken for Crimea, which I think would be a theoretical thing you could claim to go into a negotiation. But they're doing it too early. They're gonna get rolled back too soon, so it's dumb.
No, because they were always going to get rolled back, and Russia would never agree to that, and that's why it's dumb. Like, it's not actually, like, the timing doesn't actually matter. I mean, I get what you're saying, but, like, again, it just speaks to the absolute retardation at all. Like, the idea that's what I'm saying, like, maybe this is ultimately us sort of, you know, doing a big brain synthesis, like, because yeah, that is also sort of what Volcker and these neocon neoliberal types were saying was yeah, like essentially, I guess the theory of the case was that the presence of Ukrainian troops on Russian soil would be so destabilizing that I guess yeah, Russia would have no choice somehow but to give all these concessions in exchange for the return of Russian land to Russia. The problem is, like, first of all, that's a fundamental misreading. I don't actually know which is worse. It's a fundamental misreading of both the military situation and the, like, psychological situation. The idea that, like, these are related because Russia and the Russian people and the Russian government and the Russian military, everybody knows, like, this is, and obviously, you know, we do too. And anyone paying attention, anyone who's, like, connected to reality understands. There is zero chance of this Kursk invasion, like, capturing and holding Kursk City or something. Like, this is not... There's no universe in which this is a... Like they're going to, like, take Kursk Oblast in any meaningful sense. Or not just get kicked out. Like, there's no... they may be able to set up shop... along what, like a 10-20 kilometer incursion line, maybe for like a couple months if they make a really, really hard effort to entrench immediately and focus on that at the expense of further territorial gains, like maybe, but they're still going to get pushed back. Like Russia, and more importantly, and that's back to the psychological thing. Russia's just going to take that as a challenge. Russia's not going to be like, okay, so you're now, you have, you know, whatever units 10-20 kilometers inside geopolitical Russia. Therefore, you know, well, in order to get you to leave, we're going to have to give you Crimea back or whatever, or even just, you know, Zaporozhye or something. It's just not happening because everybody involved with a brain that's connected to the real world understands there's zero chance of the Ukrainians not getting kicked out by force. So why would Russia ever, ever agree to that? And now, all they've done, all this is fundamentally done, and, you know, whatever we have our criticisms of Russians with attitude, but they were saying, and I completely believe them, that, like, all this has done is essentially kick the hornet's nest. And actually, it wasn't even just them. It wasn't Volcker, it was the Cato guy was saying, he was doing, like, essentially this wiffle-waffling over elites because he was essentially, like, the interview... That was one of the few things that actually stuck out to me is, oh, he's telling the truth, kind of accidentally on purpose or something. The interviewer asked him sort of, you know, what's going on, you know, what are the effects of the Kursk operation? Is this actually making Putin unpopular? The first words out of the Cato guy's mouth were, well, actually, it has, like, even, no, and even the liberals are now, like, more on board with Putin than they were beforehand. And then he immediately pivoted to, like, well, and then, like, he caught himself. So he's like, well, of course, you know, a lot of Russian liberals are in prison, which is a lie. Like, it's just a fucking lie. Like, there's no, like, there's no Russian liberals in, I mean, this is just ridiculous. And furthermore, this was also, I think it was Ryan Falk was saying this on Twitter, which is a great point. Like, because people were saying this is another kind of like, I mean, it's been persistent, but it's amped up in the past. Yeah, since the Kursk offensive, if you want to call it, I don't know, offensive is to raid, the Kursk raid, kicked off. They were like, oh, well, you know, Russia's this horrible authoritarian state, and people are getting arrested for opposing Putin and saying bad things about him in public. And he was like, no, they're not. And furthermore, how about you go to London and start talking about how Britain is for the British and Muslims need to leave? Like, you do that for half an hour in London. I'll go to Moscow for half an hour and talk about how Putin sucks and is stupid and the war needs to end or whatever. And let's see how each of these things goes, right? it's funny.
Yeah. Do you want to kind of get into the?
Let's talk Donbass. Or whatever.
Well, I kind of want to talk my military industrial complex stuff. So
sure. Yeah.
The biggest thing that you've noticed in the Kursk thing is that both sides seem to have redirected nearly all of their FPV drones to Kursk because it's the complex moving and that's where they can be most effective. I wonder how this will affect Greater Donbass because both sides, like Lancet usage and Ukrainian equivalent usage, is like crazy right now in Kursk. Like it's probably a factor of 10 over whatever else has.
Which again, I read as like both sides understand this is like maybe not necessarily the definitive battle of the war, but as a candidate,
it's like the only target-rich environment, you know, where no people
sure.
aren't dug in and
there's
been
a lot of
dug
things
in there
going
for
on.
Years.
Yes.
So like,
yes,
it's where you can torch bang for your buck. But this is going to cause weirdness on other parts of the front, which I don't know. This may result in the Russians being better because the Russians have, like at this point, okay, there's no FPVs left. Russians still have artillery everywhere. They're going to win. FPVs are kind of the way you balance
your artillery. Well, from what I have intuited, which, I mean, you know, is essentially just, we can call this my speculation bullshit if you want, but the primary, like, actual use of FPVs, like, or the real effective use case is chasing down vehicles, which means in order for them to be really worth, in order for them to have a big impact, there need to be a lot of vehicles in play, which is what we're seeing in Kursk, number one. And number two, like, okay, yeah, like there's been cool infantry assaults where dudes dismount from BMPs and raid trenches and shit in Donbass, but that's just like one thing that happens, and it doesn't necessarily happen all that frequently. There's been super cool like action movie shit with motorbikes and various other. I mean, it's not like. There's no, I guess my point is, the FPV, I get what you're saying about FPV impact. I just, given that the Donbass theater as a whole is so attritional, and from what I have seen, armor in particular has mostly been used as, like, supporting fire. We've seen, that's been the case pretty much all along. There have been some tank battles, and there have been cases of, you know, armored spearheads entering urban whatever. But it doesn't, like, typically it's much more of in a fire support kind of role. So, given all that, yes, drones are an omnipresent threat on the battlefield. Even if you're just, there's been heartbreaking videos of like individual soldiers being targeted by individual drones, right? So that's a fucking crazy dystopian thing that's like part of the face of 21st century warfare. But one individual soldier just doesn't necessarily matter all that much. And, you know, you, like targeting one individual soldier at a time with one individual drone at a time isn't necessarily the greatest use of anybody's resources. So Yeah, the real impact I think is generally that I've seen has been on vehicles, and despite that, like, or whatever, I mean, yes, clearly Russian stockpiles or authorized use has been concentrated in Kursk for at least a week, really since the, you know, thing kicked off, and who knows how much of that is capability that would not have been it would have been available in Donbass but is no longer. But I'm just not convinced that it really, like, the fact that Russian operational tempo has increased in Donbass significantly with no letting up. I mean, that's the other thing you were mentioning about the withdrawal from New York. Yes, that was operationally, strategically the correct thing to do. But the thing of it is, that line had been there since 2014. I remember, like, New York, the Russians were banging their head on New York, like, again, like, you know, Slavic potato farmer hitting his head against a brick wall kind of situation. From the summer of 22 all the way up until probably last year, the end of last year, where they quieted down, but never really stopped. And it's been in the Russian military and the Telegram and all these, the Russian media sphere side of things, really, really played up during that whole period as this impregnable fortress. Okay, you can always dig trenches, but it.
But I thought Avdiivka was the last impregnable fortress.
No, I mean, New York, that's what I'm saying. New York in particular had been built up. I mean, you could say the same thing about
Chasiv Yar, right?
Or Konstantinovka. I mean, okay, yes, there are. So
I will say, the current Sursky strategy is find the strong points. Like, we can give up ground until we find a strong point, and then we're going to defend the hell out of this strong point. Once this strong point gets flanked, we pull back, right? That's a very adequate strategy. It's doing them gang. It is the Russians are being humiliated in Chasiv Yar. The boys of the Duran, who I generally enjoy, are just lying about Chasiv Yar. They were saying that there are Russian troops in the center of Chasiv Yar, or in whatever his weird Greco-Anglo accent. There's not. The center of Chasiv Yar is kilometers behind the line. They took the first suburb. They call it a micro district. And the Durangers had to call that, oh, well, because, like, it's cut off from Chasiv Yar with this river, we'll call this the center of the city.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it's not how
it works. Every town with a concentration of high-rise buildings is a fortress. If there's a river going through it, it's a mega-fortress, and that's just the way it is. Russia has, in the last couple weeks, got to the river. You know, they were just grinding through, like, the Ukrainians actually had to cross the river to reinforce their guys. Like, you can defend, like, it's easier to defend, and they have a battle rhythm in place where they can lose ground at an acceptable rate. That's just the case. Like, the Sirsky isn't retarded. He's okay with losing ground, and especially if they're making the Russians pay for it. They're holding these strong points very well. If you look at the DPA daily update, every day it's like some strong points will occasionally fall, but usually it's strong point repulse, and then the Russians advance somewhere there's no defenses. Which also what is happening in Kursk, where the actual advances are where there's just nobody to defend. That's the best way to attack is to attack just where they aren't, right?
Well, yeah,
and that's doctrine, right?
Yeah, obviously. Right? Yeah. That's fine, but the thing is, if you look, I think we're at the phase now where Russia has operation level maneuverability. We are now talking, like, to me, the big picture is, okay, maybe they're not, you know, you measure progress in hundreds of meters rather than tens of kilometers, but it's pretty clear, like, the Russian military is making an advance on Pokrovsk, and the Ukrainians basically are incapable of stopping it. And not just Pokrovsk, they've cut off the...
They'll get there, and then the fight starts. Like,
yes.
The Russia shills crow about, like, oh, we've taken all the
thing,
land.
But the thing is, once... If you look at a map, it's called map posting. It's called... We do a little map posting. If you look at a map of Pokrovsk, like, the supply line highway that feeds Konstantinovka and Chasiv Yar goes through... Like, it's... This is the like these things are connected, you know. These are not isolated. In other words, it doesn't benefit them necessarily to like to take Chasiv Yar if they can penetrate into the Ukrainian operational rear and cut off the supply or do it, you know, close enough to it. Like that's going to have downstream effects for the whole front all the way up to Kramatorsk at least. And really this is also allowing a play for Slavyansk. And I do think that Slavyansk Kramatorsk, like that's, you know, clearly that's going to be a, who knows? You know, like that could take a while, or not. I don't know. But it's. I guess to me, it's not so much about like the real folly of the reason. Again, the reason why, especially if we're gonna go with the thesis that Zirsky's actually pretty good at his job, you need to be able to do something. You have to do something about this ongoing collapse, because we're basically at the teetering on the verge of collapse in Donbass, at least, you know. And then okay, maybe you can set up shop. There are like a handful of urban agglomerations, but nothing on the scale like, even of Avdiivka, essentially all the way to the Dnieper. So I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like I've heard this before.
You have. I've been saying this for a while. I mean, I started saying this in, and I said, I'm reluctant. I made a point of not attaching timelines as best I could. In my mind, I guess I thought we'd be fighting for Pokrovsk around now, like late summer, early fall. Which I guess it's still, but they're clearly not. I don't know. I don't know. Actually, it's entirely possible. Who knows? You know. Like maybe we could see a fight for Pokrovsk in October. That still seems a little early for me. Just, you know, I've had to adjust things backwards. But yeah, I don't think the Ukrainians have. I think their ability to their strike package, their assault power was concentrated in Kursk to the extent that they really, like, are in deep, deep, deep operational shit in Donbass, in a potentially irrecoverable way, or at least, you know, it's going to move the line
quite a bit. I don't think the Russians are capable of creating, like, this grand roll-up. They're just too conservative. I think that's the call the Ukrainians made. It's like, okay, we would have sent these reserves to New York. We're sending them to Kursk instead.
I don't think that sending them to New York is necessary. I think you're right. The play...
There will not be a domino effect.
The Russians move...
don't do domino effect stuff.
Well, but there haven't been domino... Yes, they haven't taken opportunities as they've been presented, potentially, including, arguably, in Kursk right now. I mean, if they...
They will not do this encirclement idea, yeah, which is bullshit. That's not what they do. Like, they don't psychologically. So the Russians are still casualty averse in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Like,
no, that's true.
In Chasiv Yar, they use like very small probing infantry attacks, like of like a 10-man squad. You know, like a couple, several 10-man squads, all very well distributed, like working in concert to try to storm an area. they're not committing, like, in the Avdiivka era, they were committing, like, we're sending this battalion of fucking BMPs up this fucking road, and so help me God, you know? They have, like, calmed down from that, and they're back on their slow game in a lot of ways. They're taking ground in the aggregate because they're doing it in so many places, but they're not, like, there's no real, like, the biggest ground taken was the salient in New York, because the guys in New York, they just folded it up and retreated, right? Like, the Russians are not, like, there is no blitzkrieg. Like, it's not happening. There's no encirclement.
They don't need to do blitzkrieg, is what I'm saying. Like, it's not...
Because of that, they won't get this, like, effect you're
creating. No, I disagree. You don't need... my point is, you don't need to do blitzkrieg. Like, that's... You don't need to do blitzkrieg to create dominoes. Like there. I agree with you. For a lot of reasons, the blitzkrieg thing of whatever, you know, to whatever extent it was ever even really real, but in, let's say, popular imagination and historical legend of driving armored fists, like, through the countryside, around population centers to reach decision-making centers and cut supply lines, like, that's gone, and because of FPV drones, probably never coming back. But that doesn't mean that, like, you still need, like, supply lines. I mean, you know, like, cutting off highways is a huge deal. And cutting off this particular highway from Pokrovsk to Konstantinovka and Chasiv Yar, like, it will be a huge deal. They already basically are there. But when they actually cut it physically, occupying interchanges, that's going to have an effect. I mean, you can't just drive trucks through the countryside around Russian controlled sections of highway. Like, it's just not going to happen. So yeah, it's a big deal, and that's what I guess is my forecast. Timelines, I'm not gonna. I mean, I already gave a kind of, who knows? We'll see. But what I expect is operational tempo to continue to increase. Probably another. Like, I think it's going to settle at a rate roughly double what it was before the Kursk operation began on the Ukrainian side, and I think they're going to just do the attritional thing, but do it faster and grind down highways and cut the Pokrovsk to Konstantinovka highway, and probably also cut once they're there, they can cut the Pokrovsk to Kramatorsk highway. It's just like a northern highway instead of an eastern highway. And if they and then like talking about dominoes, yeah. Once you do that, then especially all those little rural positions around Konstantinovka and Chasiv Yar, like, those have to get, like, the supplies to them come from small little country roads branching off of that highway that just got cut. So you cut off that highway, you cut off all those country roads that are supplying all those little shithole positions that are screening Konstantinovka and Chasiv Yar. And so you just rinse repeat with that, like, over and over again along the whole front line. Like, you don't need to do blitzkrieg. You don't need to do big armored fists. You could just fab every single little shithole position in a line leading to a highway, and then set up shop on the highway, and then just fab all the little shithole positions that are now starved of supplies. I mean, even food and medicine. No high octane action movie shit required.
I don't know. I think this would have panned out before. Like, we've seen the Ukrainians manage to supply these places without highways and not collapse
immediately. Where? Right? Well, not immediately, but where were you talking about in particular?
I think Bakhmut notoriously held on way longer after the that final spot line was cut. Like months.
No. They held on until they had that one. No, once that last road was, and I don't. They never established a full physical encirclement. No, but they always had
they had
that
ATGM
one,
control over the one country road. And
no, it was a high. Well, however, there was the main artery. I don't know. I don't remember exactly how big it was. I don't think it was a. It was bigger than a country road, but less big than a national highway. It was a road. It was a functional road. It was the main supply road. And once Russia established ATGM control over that supply road, it was done in a month.
But that's a big and difference and than, like, you're sure, like, these highway, like, cutting high, you, like, you've driven around, you can drive around America, like, yeah, you don't have to use the interstate to get everywhere, you know, like, it's not, it's faster.
No, but,
like,
but you can't, I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll see. But Russia is certainly operationally behaving as though they think, like, they are treating these highways as major objectives. This one interchange in particular by this town, Vodyane, but there are others. And, I mean, it's just they are acting as the, like, because they're essentially striking in those directions in between population centers. Yes, you can survive. I mean, you can survive in circle. How, like, the, what was it? The VDV in Volchansk was surrounded for a month. You can do it. It's not fun, but it's like certain units are essentially built for that. Whatever. The thing is, on a long, like, it, what it does is degrade your ability to get supplies and to fight at a basic level, compounding over time. Which, yeah, I mean, that's, and then gets us into, like, again, this time issue. Like, the, it's all well and good to trade land for time, but you need to be doing something in the time that will, like, get you more land in the future. And Kursk does not do that. Right?
Yeah, no, I don't think, I just don't think Kursk is as important. I think the forces at Kursk will fall back in a coherent, good order, whatever, they will get reinforced with more American equipment and more Ukrainian people and return to their firefighting role. I don't think we see the destruction of any of these brigades in any meaningful sense at all, really. I think the Kursk thing is much lower risk than it's given credit for.
Maybe, but what about all the equipment?
Yeah, but what do you mean? Like, it's American. Like, it's they're gonna get more Strikers, more Bradleys, more whatever's, more Max Pros. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Authorized maybe. Strength, bro.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I mean, look, I.
It's at a good place.
Yeah, we can end. Sorry, I think you might be.
Is that a good place to call it? I think we're gonna go into. Oh, a little delay. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like we're having issues, and the only other thing I was going to ask, I could call it here myself, was if you wanted to say a little bit about Israel, but we could do that another time. Wait for Iran to, you know, poke with the stick and do something.
Yeah, I've been talking Israel pretty heavily. Yeah, I've been talking Iran pretty heavily on the other shows, so I think people are covered on that.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yes. No. That your show with Mike was great, and that's what I was saying. Is like I don't know if you had anything to add. To what you already said there, so yeah. In case if you haven't listened, definitely listen. Lewis was on Tedious last week. I don't know when if I put this. We'll see. I don't know when this will go up exactly, but in any case, yeah. We hope to be back on a more regular schedule. I know we've been irregular for a while. We appreciate your patience, but yeah, we should be. Back and maybe potentially we'll see. Talk about video games. It's you never know.
I've been playing a lot, so yeah.
Cool. All right. Yeah, it sounds like a good place to call it. Till then, take care and stay safe, everybody.